The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm your host, Denver Frederick, and thanks for making the time to join me. There is a foundation up in Boston which did its work very quietly for a number of years, but has become much more public of late and has made quite the impression. It is the Barr Foundation, and with us this evening is their president and CEO, Jim Canales, who believes that foundations should do more than just provide financial support.
But I also think that we have an obligation to think about the other kinds of resources that we can bring to the table that advance the issues that we care deeply about. And I've long believed that foundations should think about when the strategic and thoughtful use of their voice, of their platform, ideally of the reputation that they hold, is wise to employ to advance the issues that we care deeply about.
And then you will hear from the president of Livestrong, Greg Lee, who will speak about how he looks at the corporate culture of the organization that he leads.
The corporate culture at Livestrong is all about the people. It's all about the person. It's all about you. It's all about the individual. And if you take care of the person, the human, the individual, then the office culture takes care of itself.
And finally, our Better Than Most segment will take us down to Washington, D.C., and to the offices of Harvest Plus. But first, the Business of Giving News Digest for Sunday, September 17th. Earl Lewis, the president of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation and a guest on the Business of Giving earlier this year, will step down as president at the completion of his five-year term in March 2018. Lewis plans to launch a new initiative, the Center for Social Solutions, which will focus on race and diversity, water, and the future of work. Amy's Drive-Thru, the first meat-free, organic, gluten-free optional fast food restaurant, has been a huge success. Launched just 2 years ago in Northern California, they're now making plans to go nationwide. Philip Morris International said it will spend about $1 billion setting up a foundation to reduce the prevalence of smoking, as the maker of Marlboro cigarettes aims to convert smokers into consumers of devices that don't burn tobacco. Houston Bike Share is offering bikes to people whose cars were destroyed in the flood and whose insurance won't pay for a new one. In the process, it hopes to shift the city's attitudes towards cycling as a mode of transportation. And that is the Business of Giving News Digest for this evening. I'll be back to speak with Jim Canales, the president of the Barr Foundation, right after this.
Do you remember your first job? Year Up is empowering low-income young adults with the skills and experience to get their first job. 85% of alumni are employed or in school within 4 months of graduation. Support opportunity for all. Visit yearup.org.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving with Denver Frederick.
No matter what the field of endeavor, we all enjoy watching organizations take shape, emerge and grow, and evolve into something that increases their effectiveness and impact. There's a foundation based in Boston that fits that description to a T. It's the Barr Foundation, and it is fortunate to be led by one of the most capable individuals in the field of philanthropy, and he just happens to be with us now. He is Jim Canales, the president and CEO of the Barr Foundation. Good evening, Jim, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Good evening, Denver, and thanks so much for having me.
Tell us about the Barr Foundation and of your mission and goals.
So the Barr Foundation has been around for about 20 years. We have assets of $1.7 billion, and we grant approximately $80 million a year in the areas of arts and creativity and climate and education.
You know, the evolution of the Barr Foundation, at least for me, has been a fascinating thing to watch. You know, it started out as sort of an anonymous giving entity, and it evolved into a family foundation, and now it has become a professional operation and a major legacy foundation. Tell us about that journey, Jim, and some of the challenges along the way.
So the foundation was created by two individuals who are enormously generous and strategic about the kind of impact they want to have. Amos and Barbara Hostetter created the foundation 20 years ago. Amos was one of the co-founders of Continental Cablevision, and that's what led to the opportunity to create the foundation. The foundation has grown over time from that initial gift to, as I said earlier, $1.7 billion in assets. And the foundation did start anonymously, and it began anonymously because Barbara and Amos felt very strongly that it was important to focus on the work and not to focus on the foundation itself.
Mm.
And that's evolved over time. And interestingly enough, part of the reason that it has evolved has been feedback from the grantees of the foundation, many of whom said to the Barr Foundation almost a decade ago that it was actually better for them to be able to be public about where the funds were coming from, that the foundation had achieved a certain kind of reputation in the community as a thoughtful grant maker, and that being anonymous was not necessarily serving them well. And that, I think, was a pivot for the foundation. Now, I arrived in 2014, so I've only been there for about 3.5 years. And in that time, there's a lot that we have done, and there's a lot more that we have to do.
Oh, I bet. But that's good to have co-founders who listen, and they listened, and they acted on that listening. You know, you mentioned a moment ago you have three major program areas. I'm going to ask you to say a word or two about each one. The first is arts and creativity, and lots of things going on here, like Boston Creates. What's your overarching goal of your arts and creativity program?
So arts and creativity is focused on the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. So originally the arts program had a focus on Boston. Mm-hmm. And as part of a strategic planning effort that we went through a couple of years ago, we made the decision that Barr was going to take a more regional approach to its grant making. And within that, we decided that arts and creativity would become a statewide program. And our focus is how do we create and foster a creative, vibrant, cultural and artistic community for the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And we focus in three principal areas. One is how do we invest in arts organizations so that they can become adaptive and relevant given so many changes that are going on around them, which I'm happy to get into. We also focus on ways that the arts can connect with other sectors in ways that ultimately contribute to that vibrancy that I described a moment ago. And then we also focus on ways to build advocacy on behalf of the arts.
Yeah. Arts have really become a key driver in urban renewal, haven't they?
They have. And in fact, we've seen a lot of that in the Commonwealth. One of our partnerships is with the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and we focus on ways that we might revitalize certain cities that have suffered significant changes because of changes in industry, and ways that certain spaces that have been fallow, basically, could be revitalized and used for creative purposes. And so this is one of the partnerships that we've been engaged in the last number of years, and we see it as a hopeful sign to think about ways that you can repurpose these old mills, these old buildings, these old factories to foster the kind of creativity and the kind of entrepreneurship that I think will help these cities to turn things around.
Great stuff. Second program is around climate. Now, we sometimes don't think of a locally focused organization doing something on climate, but that would not be the case. And part of your focus there is around an initiative called Smarter Travel, Smarter Places. What's the strategy here?
So the strategy for that evolved from a decision that was made about 7 years ago. The foundation had a broad-based environment program up until that time. And in 2010, the foundation trustees made the decision that it was evident that climate change was one of the most urgent and pressing issues of our time. And as a result, that the environment program should shift into a climate program. And in deciding how to focus the climate program, they looked at what were the greatest sources of greenhouse gas emissions in the region. And they were buildings and transportation. And so that's what led to a focus on energy and on transportation as two core areas of focus. We did that work for about 5 years. And as part of a planning effort that we undertook a couple of years ago, we shifted to a focus on clean energy and renewables, and then a focus on mobility. So what we think about with our mobility focus is how we can achieve two things: how we can reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and at the same time, focus on how we help people to get where they need to get in a more efficient and effective way.
Mm-hmm. Human-centered design, to a certain degree, it's around people.
It's very true.
Mm-hmm. And finally, there is education, and your concentration here is around secondary schools and your desire to see that all students succeed. What is working there, and what are you especially excited about these days?
So I think your emphasis on all students is absolutely right. And many people across the country look at the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and say, wow, Massachusetts is a real success story. Across many indices, Massachusetts is often at the top in terms of student achievement and in terms of other measures that we use to assess academic achievement. But underneath that data, you come to realize that it may not be that excellent for all students.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what led us to focus on ways that we can think about re-envisioning secondary education in ways that create more relevant experiences for students when they're in high school, in ways that help them to connect to both post-secondary and career opportunities, and also in ways that perhaps personalize the experience and that realize that every student comes at this from a different perspective and with a different set of competencies. And if we can reimagine the way we deliver secondary education in a way that acknowledges acknowledges the need for that kind of personalization, we can really make a significant difference for those students, particularly those who are at greatest risk of dropping out.
Can you give us an example of one of the things that you're supporting?
Sure. So one of the things that we're most excited about that we launched last year is a $30 million initiative over the next 5 years that is particularly focused on helping those students who are off track. And off track students are those who are at greatest risk of being disconnected from either their academic tracks or even disconnected from work to the extent they're not in school. And so our effort is, how can we create models that are effective at engaging students who are off track, that help them to be successful in those academic environments, and to create pathways for them to connect to post-secondary education or to career opportunities if that's what's relevant for them?
Mm-hmm. And one last and maybe relatively new program area, if you will, is this cross program initiative. How does that work and what has the yield been from it so far?
So it's early going for us in mm-hmm. terms of cross-program initiatives. And let me say a little bit about its genesis. We have these three program areas. We're structured as many foundations are with these subject matter areas and fields that we focus on of arts and creativity and climate and education. But we also thought long and hard in our strategic planning effort about ways that we could engage in activities that might, in essence, undergird all of that. So one of the areas of focus in cross-program initiatives is around leadership.
Hmm.
And so we think not only about strategies that we can employ within our programs that advance the leadership capacity of organizations that we are supporting, but we also think about other initiatives that we might undertake. So for example, we have had since 2005 a program called the Bar Fellows Program. And the Bar Fellowship provides a great opportunity for about a dozen effective leaders in the Boston area. We award these fellowships every 2 years, and we provide these dozen leaders with an opportunity to engage with one another, engage with a peer cohort, for an opportunity to disengage from their day-to-day work by providing them with a sabbatical experience, an opportunity to do a global trip together so that they can understand how some of the issues that they work on in the region actually play out in other settings. And it's a 2-year opportunity that really does create a sense of fellowship for these leaders. And we often find that for leaders who are really committed, really passionate, and really dedicated, they often don't take the time to take care of themselves and mm-hmm. to think about their own ongoing growth and development. And that's the purpose of the program.
That's so needed and is so important. You know, you mentioned a moment ago the Barr Foundation is deeply committed to the greater Boston area and now the whole New England region. And I don't think anywhere is that more evident than your engagement around one of the region's treasures, and that's the Boston waterfront. Share with our listeners what is happening with it and the role the Barr Foundation is playing in connection with this civic enterprise.
So I suspect that many of your listeners will recall the infamous project from several decades ago known as the Big Dig, because it received a lot of national attention because it was a significant infrastructure project that, as you know,
That lasted several decades,
and that, as you know, depressed the central artery to create an opportunity for better mobility, of course, but perhaps most importantly, to also think about ways to connect the city to the waterfront.
Mm-hmm.
One of the abiding concerns that we have about the waterfront and the reason that we're engaged in it is that we think of Barr's role as adopting a long-term perspective and thinking about how decisions that we make today are going to have an impact for future generations. And in Boston, there has been significant development that has taken place in an area that was known as the Innovation District, variably South Boston. It has multiple names that are often attached to it, the Seaport. But this is an area that has undergone significant growth over the last number of years. And lots of buildings have popped up, and many people will say that it's a neighborhood that now looks very different than it did a decade ago.
Mm-hmm.
Our concern has been, what are we doing to ensure that the waterfront remains a treasure that we are stewarding and remains a treasure that is attentive to issues of open space, that is attentive to issues of access for all residents and visitors to Boston, and also attentive to issues of resiliency? And I'll come back to that point in a moment because it's a real issue for us in Boston given our location. So the Waterfront Initiative is our effort to ensure that we're helping the city and the broader region think about how we ensure that this treasure is something that we steward in the right ways and that we're not making decisions today that are going to have a bad impact for future generations.
Mm-hmm. You know, so many people today believe that the future is being created in cities and not so much anymore at the state or the national level. And foundations like yours are playing a more active and energetic role across the country. I think two great examples would be Heinz Endowments in Pittsburgh and Kresge in Detroit. How do you see the role of philanthropy and foundations changing in this regard? And what, in addition to the resources you can bring, are you bringing to the table?
So I think cities, many people have written that cities are a really fundamental agent of change in this era. And in fact, given our focus on climate, many people will look at the work that we do and say, well, you're addressing such a large issue and it's a global issue and there's probably not a lot that you can do in a regional way. But the reality is many people say that on the climate question, that a lot of the action is happening at the local level, cities and states, and that's why we engage in that way. I think for us in Boston, we have a great opportunity as a foundation to be a constructive partner to the city of Boston on a number of initiatives where we have shared goals and we are aligned with regard to our priorities. Boston has had a new mayor for the last 3.5 years,
right.
Mayor Walsh, who inherited a legacy of Mayor Menino, who had been there for 2 decades in that role. And with Mayor Walsh's arrival, it has offered an opportunity for Boston to think in new and fresh and different ways. And he kicked off for the first time in 50 years a major citywide planning effort to think about what do we want Boston to look like in 2030, mm-hmm. an effort entitled Imagine Boston 2030. There are a number of components of that project that we were involved in directly because we felt that philanthropy could play a unique role to ensure that this kind of planning was done with the kind of thoroughness and with the level of community engagement that the mayor was deeply committed to and that we knew was going to produce a better outcome than simply having this be a top-down plan that had been developed. So for us, the ability to work in partnership with the city, to think about ways that we can be constructive partners together, to acknowledge that no single sector is going to have a monopoly on all of the solutions. These are tough issues, and they're going to require multiple sectors coming together to address them, and that's the role that we want to play.
Well, you know, your involvement with City Hall, I think it's probably welcomed by most people, but like all things, not by all. I mean, has there been any pushback for the level of influence that you have at City Hall and how to react to that pushback?
Well, there has been. There have been stories that have talked about the Barr Foundation being a source of unelected power in Boston. And my response to that is that I think we view our role not as trying to drive any particular kind of outcome, but rather as ensuring that we're informing the work that is taking place at the city in a way that, again, is broad-based, in a way that brings many voices to the table, in a way that ensures that good data and research is informing decisions that might be made, and in a way that is consistent with our values and the kinds of goals that we have for the foundation.
Mm-hmm. I had Derek Rapp, the CEO of the JDRF Foundation, on the show the other day. I never really fully appreciated how difficult it was for somebody with type 1 diabetes to keep things in balance. You got to keep the sugar not too high, not too low, and the environment around you is always in a state of flux, whether it's your hormones or stress or the amount of exercise. Now, I'm not comparing what you do to that, but balance in your work is critical, and it can be really difficult to achieve. What are some of the tensions that you experience in doing that, and what do you do to maintain a healthy balance?
I love the analogy about balance. It's such a good one, and I think then the way you frame it around tensions is so appropriate to the work that we do in foundations. I think in philanthropy, we are often balancing many kinds of tensions. One example is we often think about the focus on outcomes. And mm-hmm. as you know, there's been such an emphasis over the last decade plus on foundations needing to be more focused on outcomes, on the need for logic models and theories of change. And that's a lot of jargon that essentially speaks to the importance of being clear about what we're trying to do with our resources. And at the same time, we also think about philanthropy as being the risk capital for the social sector and the opportunity to invest in ideas that are innovative, that are perhaps going to fail. And sometimes those come into tension with one another, because if you're solely focused on a particular kind of outcome, and in fact, if you're solely focused on being able to measure the work that you're doing as a foundation, you might miss those opportunities to invest that kind of risk capital in a sector that desperately needs that kind of investment and looks to private philanthropy in particular to be that sort of investor.
Now, that's a great point. You know, another one of those tensions is between adopting a long-term perspective, something which foundations can uniquely do, and addressing those urgent needs that are lining up outside your front door. Give us an example where you've encountered that kind of attention and how you sought to maintain a balance while addressing it.
I described earlier how we had gone through a strategic planning process a few years ago, and we completed that process at the end of 2015 and announced a whole new set of priorities and directions for our grant making in early 2016 and had been doing that work for that year. And then we had the presidential election in November of 2016. And this is less a political statement, but more about some of the after effects that we were seeing as we turned into this past year. One of the things that we were seeing is we were concerned about the particular vulnerabilities for immigrant and refugee populations, given some of the policies that were being advanced by the new administration. We were also concerned about, and interesting to say this as we sit in a radio studio, we were concerned about attacks on the media and the idea that the media were the enemy of the American people, which I believe was a quote. And both of those realizations led us in the early part of this year to announce a special initiative, a $3.5 million commitment by our foundation to two strands of work, one around supporting frontline organizations in Massachusetts that were dealing with an influx of need from immigrant and refugee populations, and second, investing in investigative journalism, which is, as many people in media would tell you, is expensive, is hard to do, takes time, takes resources, and we wanted to be sure that entities that were doing that kind of work had the resources at their disposal to do their best work. So that was an example where a year out of a strategic planning effort, we had to do some recalibration and think about some reallocation of resources because the environment around us had shifted. And I think for all foundations, we are constantly thinking about this balance of how do you stay focused and be clear and have impact over a certain period of time, but at the same time, not do it in a way where your head's in the sand and you're not acknowledging that things are changing around us and we need to be attentive to that change.
A very balanced answer and well stated, I might add. Let me ask you something about the sector at large, and this has to do with diversity, equity, and inclusion. And there certainly have been some thoughtful and well-intentioned efforts around this, but they haven't been all that effective. And that was really brought home to me the other day when I looked at this Board Source report that just came out. And it indicated that 90% of all nonprofit CEOs are white and 84% of board members are white. And the thing that I was really struck by is that those numbers have actually gone up since 2015. As a matter of fact, when it came to all white boards, that went from 25% to 27%. And this is really just one indicator of diversity. So why do you think these initiatives are not working as well as they should? And what do you think needs to be done to make this effort more effective?
Well, this is a big issue. When you look at the demographic changes that are taking place across our country, those numbers that you're reading are not reflective of not only our current demography, but also not reflective of the kind of demographic shifts that we are going to be seeing in the future. I think with regard to the nonprofit sector, and I think a lot about philanthropy, where this is an issue that often comes up in terms of the lack of people of color in leadership roles, it is interesting that of the 25 largest foundations by asset size, six of those are led by people of color. Probably not the most impressive statistic to say that roughly a quarter are led by people of color, but I dare say that if you looked at that data maybe 10 years ago, 15 years ago, it would probably look different, and I think that the trend line has gone up, and that's a good development.
Sure is.
At the heart of this, though, I think is the question of governance and the role of the boards and how the boards are constituted and how boards make decisions when there is leadership change and the emphasis or not that they place on diversity in thinking about leadership roles and not just the executive leadership roles, but even investment in ensuring that you're developing a pipeline and whether that pipeline will lead to your organization or will lead to other organizations. That's an institutional investment that you're making and a statement that you're making about the importance of diversity in your institution.
You know, you are a California boy, Jim, through and through. And when you accepted this job at Barr Foundation, you moved from one of America's great cities, San Francisco, to another one of America's favorite cities, that being Boston. What has that adjustment been like for you? And what are some of the differences that you've observed in how each city goes about its business and gets things done?
Well, other than the fact that I had to very quickly trade my San Francisco Giants hat for a Red Sox cap, that was certainly an adjustment for me. As you note, I'm not only a native Californian, but a native San Franciscan. So
right.
I'd spent most of my life in that very city. And I feel incredibly fortunate to have made a move from one world-class city to another world-class city. Cities are very similar in some respects. They're similar in population size. They're similar in scale, even similar in terms of having vibrant waterfronts. And so in that sense, it's been a good change. Winter has been something to adjust to, of course.
You never adjust.
You never adjust. And, of course, my first winter was that horrific winter of 2014, 2015, when we had record snow in Boston. So the cities are in some ways very different. And in other ways, they're also very similar, but in other ways, they're also quite different. And one of the ways that they're different is that philanthropy is very different in Boston. There is a culture that is more anonymous in its style. There is a culture that often aims to do that kind of work quietly. And that's not to imply that in California, people were trumpeting what they were doing. But of course, California is a home of venture philanthropy. It's a home of Silicon Valley. There's a very different kind of approach and style, particularly with many of the new donors who are coming online. And I think one of the great opportunities in Boston is for BAR to play a role with many others, including a great community foundation at the Boston Foundation, led ably by my colleague Paul Grogan, to work in partnership with the philanthropic community in Boston to think about the kind of philanthropic community that we want to be, what we aspire to, the ways that we can work together more effectively. And I've been very heartened by the level of collaboration and the willingness to find ways to partner together. Indeed, in reference earlier to the special initiative that I described, much of the work that we did in that initiative was in partnership with other local foundations in Boston, and quite frankly, following in the lead of those foundations who had done a lot of that work prior to our arrival on the scene.
Good insights. Let me ask you about your corporate culture at BAR, and I know that you give this a lot of thought and are very intentional around issues like this. As a matter of fact, you're one of the few leaders I know who thought less about what he was going to do when he came to an organization and more about how he was going to go about doing it. Describe the corporate culture and the things that you and your team have done to make it unique and distinctive and a special place to show up every morning.
Well, with regard to culture, I have to give credit where credit is due, and I give all credit for the culture at the BAR Foundation to our co-founders. Barbara and Amos Hostetter have created a culture at the BAR Foundation that is one deeply rooted in humility, that is around kindness and respect for the people that we work for, but all in the context of excellence and rigor and quality. And those happen to be values that I personally care deeply about. They happen to be values that I tried to advance in my work along with many others at the Irvine Foundation in California. So one of the principal reasons that I took this job at BAR was I felt such a deep alignment with the values of the founders of the BAR Foundation. And I arrived as a result to a culture that embodied all of that. And so now the opportunity to continue to foster that and to also think about ways that we continue to embed that culture into the DNA of our enterprise so that it's a culture that outlives all of us and that becomes part of the values of the way that institution functions decades from now.
And I know that's really what the co-founders care about more than anything else. How do you animate those values? You know, so often they're on a website or they're in a booklet you get when you show up. How do you make them live and breathe every day?
I think one of the ways is you make sure that you talk about them. We talk about our values a lot at the BAR Foundation. We recently had a staff retreat in August, and part of that retreat was focused on ways that we could be a constructive partner and ways that we live out those values in our day-to-day work. I think we aim to make them tangible. It's one thing, as you say, to say, well, we aim to be curious, we embrace risk, we're about excellence, we're about humility, but we think a lot about ways that we demonstrate that. So, for example, we think about how do we balance that tension between humility, which is a deeply held value, but also a commitment to leadership. And leadership not just in the sense of investing in leaders, but leadership in the sense of understanding what our role as a leadership institution is. And so we explicitly discuss those issues as a staff and learn from one another and engage with each other. And I think that contributes to making it clear that those values are animated on a daily basis.
Let me close with this, Jim. We are in some extraordinary times. And during these extraordinary times, you believe, as you mentioned before, philanthropy has to adapt. You also are a champion of foundations losing some of their reticence, finding their voice, and really stepping forward and speaking out on issues of importance. What has the BAR Foundation done in this regard, and what are your hopes for the sector at large in how they respond to the current challenges we all face?
I think when we think about foundations, we immediately think about the financial resources that foundations have. We are grant-making institutions, after all, and one of our purposes is to award those grants to institutions doing work aligned with our priorities. But I also think that we have an obligation to think about the other kinds of resources that we can bring to the table that advance the issues that we care deeply about. And I've long believed that foundations should think about when the strategic and thoughtful use of their voice of their platform, ideally of the reputation that they hold, is wise to employ to advance the issues that we care deeply about. So I've thought about this quite a bit. We have a real commitment to transparency at the Barr Foundation. I blog a great deal. I'm active on Twitter, which incidentally I found a really valuable way to engage directly with people and get direct real-time feedback. From people. It's just the reality, which I love. But I do think that the idea of foundations using their voice is one that we all need to be thinking about when we're in philanthropic roles. I don't think it's a resource that we should be leaving on the table. And I think often in philanthropy we do. Mm-hmm. And I think we often do it at our peril as it relates to advancing our objectives.
Well, Jim Canales, the president and CEO of the Barr Foundation, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening and for a really interesting conversation. Tell us about your website and anything there that you think people might find of particular interest.
Terrific. So our website is at Barr Foundation, B-A-R-R, foundation.org. And hopefully you will find it a very vibrant, transparent, and also engaging website. I think I would particularly point you to our blog, where we are blogging all of the time about issues that we're engaging with. We invite some of our partners to guest blog as well. And also a number of us are active on social media. So we would urge you to follow us on Twitter.
I read your blog all the time, and it's a great investment in time. Thanks so much, Jim. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Denver, thanks for having me.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
Before you give to charity, go to charitynavigator.org. Charity Navigator provides free ratings of thousands of America's largest charities, helping you get the most out of your charitable dollar. Charitynavigator.org, your guide to intelligent giving.
Welcome back to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick. It is a little counterintuitive, but too many nonprofits are overly focused on mission at the expense of developing a healthy and robust corporate culture. Because, at the end of the day, it is the people who work there who deliver on the promise of the organization. That has not been lost on Livestrong, who happens to have one of the very best work cultures of any nonprofit organization in America. And here to tell us what makes it so special is Greg Lee, the president of Livestrong. Good evening, Greg, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Glad to be here and joining with you and the audience, Denver, and sharing some insight on our culture.
Why don't we first start, though, by having you tell us about Livestrong and the mission and goals of the organization?
Well, Denver, we are celebrating our 20th anniversary, and during that 20 years, we have remained focused not on cancer specifically, but on the patient who has cancer. And it's that differentiation that makes us special, because we're not focused on the disease as much as we are the person who has the disease.
Mm.
And during that 20 years, we've served more than 4 million cancer patients and their families and provided free services to them as they navigate through a cancer experience.
Fantastic. Well, Greg, you know, some organizations say they have a feedback culture or an entrepreneurial culture. Some say they have a coaching or data-driven culture. What word or phrase would you use to describe your culture?
You know, there's two or three things that come up, but I think I would say all in or active or engaged. We want our staff to be totally and completely immersed in what they're doing. This is not something where people show up at 8 and leave at 5. They're oftentimes here early in the morning. They're working out. They're on a treadmill. They're doing things. They're going to a yoga or Pilates class. They're doing something with a nutrition class or something like that. But they're totally immersed in not just the work that we're doing, but the people that we're helping serve. And so I guess if I had to put it into one phrase, I would kind of call it all in, because people literally are all in. They're given 150% of their time, energy, and effort to help others that are battling through cancer.
Yeah, they put it all out there. They leave nothing in there. They just keep on pushing. Well, you know the importance of leadership in shaping and influencing a culture. What do you do there to help influence and shape yours, and how do you model your behavior?
I think there are several things that we ask of our leaders. Quite frankly, it's a pretty simple ask, because they're all engaged and excited just like I am. But we want them to lead by example. It is really difficult to have a team be excited and immersed and really all in and actively engaged if your leadership team shows up half the time, if they show up late, or they show up with less energy. We just ask our leaders, to give 150%. And quite frankly, one thing that is very unique about our organization is people are so drawn to the cause and the work that we do that this is not something where you constantly have to motivate and inspire those leaders or those team members, because they realize the millions of Americans that are fighting through a cancer diagnosis, and they know what that feels like. And so they come already inspired and motivated to try to help those families.
Yeah,
so- but it's really more just living that model behavior rather than just talking about it.
You know, every organization has their core values. However, I go to some organizations and a lot of the people who work there don't even know what those core values are. So what do you do to animate yours and communicate them and reinforce them throughout the entire LiveStrong organization?
You know, several different things. You know, we have them on the wall. We have a written kind of manifesto, if you will, that talks about the values of the organization and our expectations. We also have awards that we provide every month to those who emulate those the most. And then probably most effectively, they're used in our performance evaluation methodologies that literally emphasize how well you live and breathe those core values. Yes, there are goals and objectives and performance accomplishments that we hope to see, but it's not just what work we get done, it's how we get it done that is also important.
Yeah, that is really critical, and that's quite unique. Most organizations are just looking at what you accomplish. You're really focusing as well on how you went about accomplishing it and how it really represented the values of the organization. What about feedback? Are you a feedback culture? Do you wait for these performance reviews, or is this sort of an ongoing thing at LiveStrong in terms of trying to talk to people about, you know, their jobs?
It comes across as a little bit of a cliche, and I certainly don't mean it that way, but we are a very transparent organization, very open door minded. My phone rings 24 hours a day. I respond to email, text message, LinkedIn requests. And the same thing holds true of our staff. We are very engaged. We're very communicative. And so there is no need to wait for a semi-annual performance check-in to voice questions or concerns. Those come up all the time. We also have monthly team meetings, and we devote a designated time of those during those team meetings to literally have full transparency and talk about operations, talk about challenges, talk about the actions we're taking to overcome those challenges, and literally leave the door wide open for staff to ask any and all questions to try to get feedback throughout the cycle. It's not enough just to do it at the beginning or a midpoint. You really need to have continuous feedback from managers and staff alike.
Good stuff. Do you have any unique rituals down there that kind of reinforce the culture?
I think there are several different things that we do. We have a kind of a midweek check-in that really we call Tell Me Something Good. That's really very, very informal. Everyone gets together in something we call the dugout, which is an old loading dock. For an informal, they grab a cup of coffee, a soft drink, and a donut, and just have a conversation about what's going on. Some of that is personal, meaning that we allow them to bring their family life and personal life and things that are happening good to them. But then also it's an opportunity for us to routinely update the team on positive things that are going on within the organization. We want to share in the lives of our team members, good, bad, and ugly. And so this is an opportunity that we take advantage of every Wednesday to kind of bring the team together and share those things that are good, bad, and really do that in this all-in kind of culture that we have.
Mm-hmm. You know, you've been there for a while, Greg. Before you were president, you had been the chief financial officer. So you've seen this influx of millennials into the workforce. How have they changed your culture?
You know, I think, I know as a leader, and I'll talk about me first, and then I'll talk about the organization. You know, we're successful not so much because of anything I do, but how I am successful in working with the other leaders in the organization. And we allow the diversity and the flexibility and the different skills and traits and personalities of our workforce to shine.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the biggest thing that we're trying to do. If my whole team was just a bunch of Greg Lees, we would probably not be nearly as successful as we are to have a wide diversity of skills and personalities and things that drive us and things that motivate us. And so I think part of our philosophy is to allow each staff member to use their own personality, their own strengths, recognize their own weaknesses, and then leave them alone, let them do their job.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's probably a lack of innovation in the social sector, and it always seems to me that of all the sectors, we're the one that needs it the most because we're probably dealing with the most intractable problems. What do you do at LiveStrong to continue to be an innovative organization?
You know, I couldn't agree more with you, Denver. I'm reminded of a book I read recently called A Whack Upside the Head, and it talks about early in one of the early chapters about how when you're a young kid, you're given a rubber band, and you can think about 5,000 uses for that rubber band, and your imagination goes crazy on the different things you could do with that rubber band if you gave it to a 7-year-old child. And yet, if you gave that rubber band to, you know, a worker in your workforce and said, what could you do with it? They'd probably say, well, I could wrap it around something in the workforce, and that would be their limited use.
Or shoot it at somebody, maybe.
That's exactly right. We want to encourage them to think more outside the box. We have a little saying around here that today's problems are not going to be solved with yesterday's solutions. Mm-hmm. We have to come up with new solutions and new ways to look at the problems that we face today.
I love your metaphor. You know, recognition's important to keep people motivated and to reinforce the kind of behavior you're looking for out of your workforce. What do you do that's distinctive and unique in the way you recognize your best people?
A couple of different things. One that is probably often done by other organizations is some kind of a routine recognition of a employee of the month or something like that. We call it our Attitude is Everything Award.
Ah.
And we do that at a midpoint in every month. We have a team meeting. We bring people together, and those are people that are nominated by the team. They are evaluated by the team, and they're selected by the team. And so it's really where people can anonymously or proactively campaign for someone who's done a particularly great job that month in giving them recognition. I think the other thing that we do that's a little bit different is there are no rules or restrictions or regulations on spot awards that we want to provide to someone. So if a manager comes to me and says, hey, Susie did really good work on Tuesday on this thing, and I want to do a gift card, or I want to have a spot award for her, or something like some kind of recognition, great, we do that. And
nice.
I think every week or two, there's something like that that goes on. I think oftentimes in a corporate environment, there is an evaluation of performance at the end of the year, and usually maybe at one or two other intervals throughout the year. We try to have this be a very continuous process, and if we see somebody that is excelling and doing something really above and beyond, we want to recognize and reward that immediately and not wait till some artificial date that happens to fall in a midpoint of a calendar.
Oh, I like both of those things an awful lot. The latter one, I think you can only say good job to somebody so often, and having a gesture like that that you can do with something a little special and a little unique is really nice. And it's funny about these recognition. As much as people love to get recognition from management, it doesn't seem to mean as much as when it comes from their peers. And when people nominate one of their colleagues, that really, I think, has an incredible resonance. So I think those are two wonderful practices. What about technology? You know, in today's world, you can really communicate, your culture through that social intranet. What system do you use, and how do you use it to try to communicate across the organization?
Oh, boy, we have so many different communication vehicles. It's really even hard to list. Obviously, we have the normal email, text message functionality. I think something that we employed, starting about 24 or 30 months ago was an in-house chat feature or an instant messaging feature where literally you don't have to wait for an email server to connect an email back and forth, and it can be very informal, simple chat-type language. You can use abbreviations. You can send them to any group or individual that you want to, but it's a way for us to be able to do that really quickly and really easily, and people can access it on their computer or a mobile device or a tablet or phone or whatever, wherever. And I think that has been very successful as well. Also, I do not want to understate the importance to us of the communication that we do via social media. For the size and scale of our organization, we have an abnormally large social media presence and following.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a way, literally, for us to touch base with our own staff, but also with constituents and families and everybody else. In literally nanoseconds, we can touch millions and millions of people and provide information in real time that's very helpful. So we do the same thing with our staff, do the same thing with our constituents. It's a way for us to communicate very efficiently and effectively. I think the one emphasis that I would have, Denver, is that years and years ago when I was first starting in the workforce, you wrote a letter to somebody and you waited for that response to come back, and it just took weeks and weeks and weeks to have a dialogue. Right now, we stress timeliness. We want calls returned within 24 hours at the absolute latest. We want you to prioritize information from outside constituents, prioritize information from colleagues and supervisors. But timeliness is really much, much more important now than it probably was, just because of the way technology has changed our environment and the expectations in the workforce.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear you say that, because I think that's been lost on too many nonprofit organizations, and that is speed. Speed is everything. And if you're going to stay near that front pack, you better move fast. And it sounds like you have a culture that moves very, very fast. Say a word or two about your efforts around diversity, equity, and inclusion.
I think this is really going back to the philosophy that you don't want a bunch of Greg Lees around the table. We don't want people in our organization that are just sitting around the table nodding heads. We want a diverse set of backgrounds. We want a diverse set of cultures. We want a diverse background of perspectives and experiences and education that really help make better decisions and help us ensure that the actions that we're putting forward are going to reach broad demographics and are going to have the kind of resonating feeling and compelling nature that we want to. And again, it's all recognizing that if you have a very diverse workforce, if you have an inclusive, diverse workforce, then you're going to come up with better solutions, mm-hmm. and your resonance with constituents is going to be much better.
Mm-hmm. You know, you said at the very top that your culture was all in, and you talked about leadership giving 150%. So that really leads me to the question about work-life balance and your efforts to try to maintain it and help people from avoiding burnout. What do you do in that regard?
A couple of different things I think are important. First, we don't punch a time clock. Mm-hmm. I do not have staff, you know, punching a time clock to make sure that they're here at 8 o'clock, and if they're here at 8:07, that I know about it, or that they, you know, take an hour and 5 minutes for lunch or things like that. We just don't punch a time clock. We hire professionals. They're expected to do their job. They work with their manager and supervisor to ensure that the hours and the time and the energy they devote is adequate to get the job done. But we don't micromanage their attendance or that sort of thing in terms of when they're walking in the door and when they walk out. The other thing that we try to do is we provide what we think is a generous package that says, hey, we want you to take, you know, 3 or 4 weeks a year to be able to decompress, to do things with your family, to enjoy some time away on vacation or out of the office. And then also we know that there are times where people are ill and they need to be out of the office to kind of get their body physically back to where it ought to be. And so we provide a generous allowance that literally lets them have 3 or 4 weeks a year to be out, and that doesn't even count holidays, mm-hmm. and other established things. So we try to provide a broad array of opportunities for them to stay away. I think another thing that we do is for those who have been with the organization 7 years, we have a 1-month sabbatical that we award that basically says, hey, wait a minute, you've given above and beyond for us for 7 years, and in addition to your normal leave time that we're going to let you have, this year we're going to let you have another month to go and reflect and refresh, and that's on us. And so that's a kind of an unusual perk, but something else that really helps with the work-life balance.
Oh, yeah, especially among those 6-year employees, I bet. Is, you know, one of the biggest complaints you get from particularly young people is that there's no road to advancement. There's no place for them to grow within the organization. And others along those same lines will say, well, I stopped learning. What does LiveStrong do to really invest in the personal and professional development of an individual? And what is that road where they can advance through the organization?
I think this all starts, Denver, with having an open, honest conversation and dialogue with each staff member about what they like, what they don't like, what they want to do, what they don't want to do, and forget for a minute about that role within the organization.
Mm.
But have an open, honest dialogue about what does the individual want to do. Now, obviously, we hope that what we do is provide an attractive environment and challenging work that directly matches up with that individual's hopes and desires and dreams. And so there's a long time, you know, career path and success at works. But that doesn't, I don't think we can orchestrate that too much. I think we have to sit back and have an honest conversation with each team member about what they like and what they don't like and where they want to grow and what their personal aspirations are, and then work to build that into their career path. And then at times be open to say, hey, I know that you want to move in this direction, and we're not moving in that direction. How can I help you do it?
Yeah.
Even though it may be external to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that kind of open, honest, sincere, authentic dialogue with each staff member, each professional staff member, is very well respected and I think very much appreciated.
I bet it is. It seems to be custom tailored and very much an individual journey, and you really try to honor that and help the individual with it. Let me close with this, Greg. Of all the things that you've discussed, and maybe some of them we haven't, what is the one thing that you are most proud of about the corporate culture at LiveStrong?
The corporate culture at LiveStrong is all about the people. It's all about the person. It's all about you. It's all about the individual. And if you take care of the person, the human, the individual, then the office culture takes care of itself. If you forget about the person and you forget about the human in all of us, then you've got a challenge with your culture. But literally, it's all about the person and the individual. And if you focus on that one person at a time, somehow the rest of the culture tends to take care of itself.
Everything falls in place. Well, Greg Lee, the president of LiveStrong, I want to thank you so much for being with us this evening. Not only is LiveStrong a great place to work, but it does great work as well. So if people want to learn more about that, tell us about your website and the kind of information you have there.
They can go to livestrong.org, and they'll find information about how to get help battling through a cancer journey. They'll also find resources that they can share with friends and family and others that they may know that are going through a cancer journey. And if you're interested in running a marathon or being active and helping us raise money to fight this disease, then there's avenues there as well. So a wide variety of information on the website, really more focused on how you can get engaged to either help someone else out or raise a little money to help out another family.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Greg. It was a real pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you, Denver. It's always a pleasure. Look forward to doing it again soon.
Johnny, that's better than most. That is better than most. Better than most!
Better Than Most is a regular feature of The Business of Giving, examining the best places to work among social businesses and nonprofit organizations.
One of the 8 semifinalists in the MacArthur Foundation's 100 and Change competition is Harvest Plus. And as you might suspect, an exceptional organization like Harvest Plus also has an exceptional corporate culture. So I made my way down to Washington, D.C. to check it out. We'll start the segment with their CEO, Bev Postma, and then hear from some of the other members of the team.
First of all, people have a work ethic off the scale. It's my challenge is telling people to go home in the evening because they're so passionate about what they want, what they do. But no, we have a very good work-life balance. We celebrate just yesterday. We had our regular Celebrate the New Babies Day. So we've got 5 new arrivals in the last few months. And what we do is we celebrate family. We celebrate our extended families. We know that our families are our support system in Harvest Plus. So we make sure that they're welcomed into the organization. Whenever we have events, we invite extended members of our staff's families. And we consider ourselves all really working towards the same cause.
At Harvest Plus, as you can see, the diversity is the key strength of Harvest Plus. And biofortification is our language. Biofortification itself is diversity. Picking different crops to work together to bring more nutrient and a diverse of nutrient. And that's what you can see in the strength of talent at Harvest Plus as well. And I can remember the first time I was interviewed for this job. What I liked the most is that everybody was involved in my interviewing process. So people asked me different questions. Everybody, raised their concerns, and I was able to openly address them. And I could see that I'm coming into a family. And that's what you can see at Harvest Plus. We have a lot of groups of small teams so you can feel like you belong to a family or a core group of friends, and that's exactly how we work at Harvest Plus.
And what I love of Harvest Plus IFPRI is the fact they provide you all the resources to tackle the specific problem. And you connect with your staff based in Colombia, based in Rwanda, through, you know, WhatsApp. We have WhatsApp groups. Mm-hmm. And we post questions, and people, you know, is always passionate about the questions we pass. So I feel like I have so many degrees of freedoms when I come to every day to Harvest Plus to answer the specific questions.
On my very first day at Harvest Plus, Brittany, who was in charge of human resources and onboarding in Harvest Plus, said to me that our founder, and at the time CEO, she had never in her 6 years at Harvest Plus once heard him raise his voice. And I thought, that can't be true, that's superhuman. But it was true. And his personality has really permeated our culture. And he was someone who had an idea that people said was too good to be true and would never work. They said it wouldn't be possible to include extra vitamins in plants. They said, even if you can do that, no farmer will grow them. Even if that happens, nobody will eat them because the vitamin A can turn the crops orange. Who's going to eat orange food? Then, well, yes, you can do that, but you know, it won't be cost effective. It turns out it is. But he spent years and years just persisting in his humble way, and now 26 million people are growing and eating this stuff. And last year, he won something called the World Food Prize. He inspired us. He talked about how it was we who had done it, not him. His first reaction when he won was to say, oh gosh, they really should have also given it to the person who's ahead of our crop breeding. Like, this is his first reaction. So that is something that is really unusual and has truly affected our corporate culture.
And nearly every single one asked me, what are my opportunities for growth here? And it's generally for administration jobs, so people want their foot in the door at an organization that's doing, you know, international development. And I love when I get that question, because I love being able to answer it by telling them that the great thing about Harvest Plus is how accessible everyone is and how multidisciplinary we are. So if you want to know more about agricultural economics, if you want to know more about advocacy, if you want to learn more about the gender work that we do, there's opportunity to engage with and speak, conversationally with someone about that.
To speak a little bit about the hiring process, I initially thought, wow, this is kind of intense. I went through several rounds of interviews with the team and with HR and various people I would be working with. But I think it actually really speaks to the level of dedication that the organization has for a fit, not just technically, but also culturally, also personality-wise. I see a lot of dedication to building that kind of family environment. Because we're such a culturally and professionally diverse organization, there is the potential for that to be a great asset, but also an insurmountable hurdle. And I think the hiring process and that level of dedication given to making sure the fit is there is really important to building that bridge and steering the diversity that we have in the right direction.
And one thing that has helped me track my progress and development as an employee throughout that process has been the review and feedback mechanisms that we have within this organization. There are standard protocols and processes for evaluations of employee work, setting of goals, and also staff developments as a part of your annual work plan. Also, in addition to these more standardized feedback mechanisms, have found a lot of value in the fact that managers from all the way in the top of the organization, across a number of different countries, and all the way to even our consultants who assist us in things we don't know, are always willing to provide candid, honest feedback on an ad hoc basis or in the moment. I found great value in people's willingness to help me to grow as an employee as I have transitioned from an entry-level employee throughout my career with this organization. And it has really helped me both learn and also set a trajectory for my future in terms of how I envision myself developing within this organization in the future.
Outside Harvest Plus, people think Harvest Plus is an organization with like 1,000 employees. We do so much, but we are very few. But one thing that is so unique about Harvest Plus in terms of our culture is the fact that when there is a task on the table, everybody come and put their hand on the deck and the job gets done. And that's exactly what's going on now with some of the high priority level tasks that are ongoing in the organization. Everybody's hand is on the deck, right from those in the field and to those on the at the headquarters. And this is what you see in a confident leadership.
I want to thank all those who participated in this piece: Peg Willingham, Brittany Leibolt, Benjamin Utel Pierce, Ottawa Oprounde, Jose Funes, and Jamie Leidelmeyer. If you want to hear this again, read the transcript, or see pictures of the participants and the Harvest Plus offices, you can find them all at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And while you're there, check out my full interview with Bev Postma, the CEO of Harvest Plus. And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and I hope you return next Sunday evening for the Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of the Business of Giving.
3-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.